The Rosie on the House Arizona Hour, driven by Sanderson Ford.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire.
You know, if you're ever driving around on I-17 and you're passing Metro Center and you see that silly-looking super salad and you ever ask yourself, what the heck were they thinking? And you concluded it probably had something to do with hippies and drugs in the 70s. Well, that's not quite the case. That was originally a bank, and I-17 wasn't there, and that tall, whatever you call it, on top of it, pitch was designed so that people driving around could see it and know how to get there because the roads weren't developed at the time it was built. In 2025, that building will be 50 years old. Phoenix is our featured staycation destination, and our winner will be staying at the new renovated hotel at Grand Canyon University next week, and we'll have them in. And there's even a chance there's a little chatter. We may even hear a little bit from current basketball coach Thunder Dan as well.
Oh, fantastic. Well, that's
I shouldn't
great.
Say anything because that always jinxes it, but there's chatter that he might be available.
Oh, awesome. Well, we're here with Chuck Montgomery, the executive director of the Hall of Flame Museum in Phoenix, and Mark Moorhead, the curator of education for the museum. It is of 300 fire equipment museums in the country. You are by far and away the largest of all of them.
Absolutely.
I mean, head and shoulders larger than everybody else.
Head and shoulders, yes. We're truly the largest fire museum in America and the world, as we know. And I would say the second largest is probably our shop where they work and repair on the trucks. It's sizable. It's to have a piece like this in the Phoenix metro area is absolutely a privilege for the state.
Well, I wanted to take this hour and just talk through the whole museum. And all we've talked about so far are the things you could see from the registration counter.
Yes. And I got to tell you, when you talk about that square footage and the shop involved and stuff, you can't imagine the wonderful set of volunteers that we have down there. As we speak right now, they're down there literally dusting and cleaning and repairing and getting the museum ready for even an event we're having this evening for the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation. So these guys—
At the museum?
Yes. These guys and gals that volunteer for us, they have wonderful leadership and they're— And just what they do for us, it makes all the difference because it allows us not only to have a great gallery to show folks like yourself when you came down, but also to get this apparatus out to events such as the Fiesta Bowl. We had 6 trucks in the Fiesta Bowl. We've been in that parade since its origins, and it really makes a big difference. So I really shout out to those guys that are, and gals that are out there this morning volunteering for us. So,
well, I can see how someone in the firefighting fraternity could love to walk the museum and maybe even just by themselves. But for those of us that aren't in that fraternity, I'll tell you, walking it with an expert and giving you the color story behind every piece of equipment made all the difference.
Oh, boy.
Are those volunteers and docents available to the public? How would you arrange to get a guided tour through these marvelous pieces of equipment?
They are available, and you had a wonderful tour yesterday from both Mark and Joe Hinkle, who are just wonderful, wonderful docents, and you can call the museum at any time and arrange a guided tour. It's always open and available for an unguided tour, and we give you a manual that lets you walk through, and now you can go to our website and kind of follow along your tour. But you're right. It adds, if you have somebody to explain and go into detail on each of these pieces, it does change the entire event. So
I would think you would have school buses lined up all the way down to the Capitol building waiting to tour the kids through that facility.
Oh, we will. We will. It's what we're changing our focus, and we're really schools, as you know, are challenged to go on field trips, and our plan for the next year is to start to emphasize how much the museum and the education that's provided there fits into the STEM curriculum. So obviously there's no part of firefighting that doesn't involve science, technology, engineering, and math, and we're going to capitalize on that, and we're already reaching out to the schools and talking to them. As you saw when you were there, we have a wonderful interaction area for the kids, but we're going to be enhancing that as well. But schools have to justify what they do, and things have to fit within STEM, and ours certainly does. So yet to come.
Oh, man. Well, everyone should see the museum. Mark, explain to the listeners, what role does a Dalmatian have at the fire station?
Well, Dalmatians.
How did that connection get made?
Yeah, one thing I'll tell you, Rosie, is that when I talk to little kids now, it doesn't always have that association. They tend to think of them in terms of those Disney movies.
Disney movies. Oh.
Right. But when I was a kid, I always thought of Dalmatians as a firefighting dog. And that goes back to the days before they had fire trucks, when horses pulled fire wagons in the 19th century. Dalmatians, like if you watch the Westminster Kennel Club dog show or something like that, they're still classed with the working breeds. It's just that what they were bred to do for the most part doesn't exist anymore. They were dogs that in Europe they were called Dalmatians because they're supposed to have come from the Dalmatia coast and what's now Croatia. But in America, in the 19th century, they were often called coach dogs or carriage dogs. And that was because their job was to run with coach horses, urban horse teams, and they'd run alongside or right behind or sometimes right in front of the horses. They'd kind of encourage them. They were also like a early horn. They would bark when they went through an intersection or something like that. And that but their biggest job, as weird as it seems, is they were guard dogs. Horse theft was a much bigger problem for people in the 1800s than car theft has been for us in modern times. People stole horses all the time. And those dogs, Dalmatians, if somebody walked up to that horse that he or she didn't know, they'd bite him on the leg or chase him away or whatever, hopefully, or at least make a lot of noise. But also they would sort of babysit horses. Horses are kind of jumpy, nervous animals. And if you've spent time with Dalmatians, you may notice that Dalmatians can be kind of jumpy, nervous dogs. You get them together and they just sort of chill each other out. Yeah. Keep them calm, babysit. They're just the horse's best friend. And anybody who had horses might have a Dalmatian, but they became really associated with firefighters because of popular art. Prints and lithographs. It was very popular to have a steamer racing through, and the artist would put in a few Dalmatians. It's a little exaggerated how common they were. It's not like every fire station had one. The first mascot of the Phoenix Fire Department was a goat, Homer the Goat. It was just a stray goat somebody found downtown somewhere, but I guess he kept busting into like the neighbor's vegetable garden, so they banished him out to a farm in Glendale somewhere eventually.
And became the mascot.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
there's a, you know, in the history of firefighting, there's a story behind virtually every single thing that you see there. The fire hose.
Yes.
And why do the older generation of fire stations all have a church steeple on them?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, if you see, like a lot of kind of that classic American old school firehouse had that usually big square structure that looked almost like a church steeple or something like that. What that was a drying tower for fabric hoses. You had to hang them up to dry them out, or they would, you know, mildew and every kind of nasty thing would happen to them if you didn't do that. Fire hose is really uncooperative. I mean, early fire hoses, they just didn't work that well. It wasn't until about 1820, long after they invented the pumpers, that they got pretty good fire hose. And if it was leather, it would dry out, crack it, rub that, you know, that glop onto it all the time.
Romy, they've actually got a piece of fire hose down there about a foot long, and it is riveted leather.
Yeah.
And the rivets are, I don't know, maybe a half inch apart. But it's just a sheet of leather rounded into a hose shape, and the seam is pop riveted the whole way down.
Yeah, they had to do it. And then, you know, it's one of those things you don't think about in modern times, but it was a tough nut to crack, the idea of something that was flexible enough to be a good play hose, a good discharge hose for fighting a fire, but at the same time was really, truly watertight. That's, you know, we're just used to having it, but that was something that took a lot of experimentation and trial and error and all of that stuff. And it was, like I said, long after the hand pumpers had gotten really sophisticated was when they got the first, you know, reasonably effective fire hose.
Well, as I say, there's a story behind every piece of equipment. There were two trucks in there in particular that just as an engineering piece of art just literally took my breath away.
Sure.
But I cannot remember the name. It was two names.
Well, there was an the Aaron's Fox.
That's it.
I saw you
were very
impressed with that. That was one of the beautiful, highly respected American fire trucks, and they had most of them had this sort of characteristic chrome ball up front. It was an air chamber that would make the discharge have a certain uniformity. And that pump is up front. And so as a result, they were real popular in areas that had waterfronts, riverfronts, lakefronts. They would, if they absolutely had to, even run a ocean water, seawater through it. They didn't like to do that. The salt was pretty hard on the pump. But if they had to, they would. And then you get the youngest guy in the company to clean it for hours when you get it back to the fire station.
They're really rolling pieces of art.
They really are.
That happen to be fire trucks.
Exactly. Yes. And you especially see that with the old stuff, the 19th century
man.
Stuff. These guys didn't just want to get to a fire. They wanted to look good getting there. And and it's especially true of American firefighters. You see the stuff from Europe or from Asia that we have, and we have some, they're nice looking, handsome, well-made pieces, but they don't have that kind of theatrical flair that American firefighters loved. And like a lot of things in America, it came from competition. They were competing with the guys down the station down the road or the next town over. If they had some big, beautiful, elegant piece of equipment, then these guys right away had to start raising money for an even bigger, even more beautiful piece of equipment.
And you're walking through the display that takes you from the 1700s, hand pumpers, hand pulled carts that were fed by bucket brigades at 60 gallons a minute, to these units that date to the early 1900s.
Yeah.
And then roll me around the corner, and there's a actual truck that was at 9/11.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
New York fire truck.
Yes. Rescue 4. It's breathtaking.
Tell the story of that actual truck.
It's breathtaking for sure. Then and Rescue 4 is from Queens, and it's had a remarkable journey after 9/11, after it was pulled from the wreckage. They damaged or destroyed about 150 fire trucks at 9/11. And for this truck to have come out and then made this journey around the country and end up ultimately in our museum is remarkable. Sadly, none of the members of that company survived, and their names are inscribed on the truck. But it's still a project that we're working on to get it back to its most original condition that it was in. But it's huge. You're right. It's Rescue 4. There were five of them in each borough in New York. And this particular one not only suffered the tragedy of 9/11, but just months prior to that had a fire called the Father's Day Fire. And on the Father's Day Fire, they lost members as well. So that year was very tragic for this company. And you're right, it is breathtaking. And I have to tell you, all the volunteers, hats off to all of them again for the work that they do on this truck to try and get it back to its original condition. A fleet of folks went back to New York just to get the original doors to bring back, because at different times the doors had been swapped out and things. So we're really cognizant of that. And of course, not within just a few feet of that truck in the next gallery, we also have the truck 7A from the Granite Mountain Hotshots, which is the buggy that they used.
Yeah.
So there's, as you said, we date from 1725 all the way to 2004. But those two pieces have tremendous significance to us, and we take care of them in the most respectful manner.
Yeah, you're kind of on hallowed ground there.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are.
Yeah. You really are. Again, the website for the museum?
Oh, our website is halloflame.org, not .com, .org, halloflame.org. And just within the last few weeks, we have a brand new webpage that'll allow you to surf through and actually look at each of the pieces that we have in categories and year breakdowns. There's videos on there. There's lots of interaction, so you'll enjoy the website.
Well, when we get back, let's give you an opportunity to make sure you give your best invite to all the Arizona homeowners to get down and check it out.
And firefighters. We really want firefighters to see this place.
Very good.
Many that need to.
Okay.